Roger Griffiths here, the publisher of The Hub. Welcome to this, our regular Friday roundtable. As I am each and every Friday, joined on this program by Sean Spear, our editor at large. Sean, we find you today in downtown Ottawa, in having attended the Strong and Free conference. We're going to talk about that a little bit in the show and bring in our managing editor, Harrison Lohman, who's been covering the conferences every beat from its start through to today. But I want to begin, Sean, with what we decided not to do on last week's show, which was the foreign interference inquiry, because we knew the Prime Minister would be up this week. And some interesting testimony today by the CSIS director. Let's focus on that first. What was your big takeaway, though, from the Prime Minister's testimony midweek?
Well, I think the thing we learned this week, Rudyard, is that Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre was right to stick to his guns through last year and into this year and insist on a public inquiry. I went back and read David Johnston's report in which he spent as much time targeting the leakers as he did the question of foreign interference. And listeners will remember that Johnston recommended against a public inquiry. He said that it couldn't be done, that it was too complicated, given that we were dealing with national security and intelligence information. And instead, he offered himself up to do a national tour to talk to Canadians about these issues and think about what we could do to protect ourselves in the future. Poilievre insisted that we needed to have a public inquiry. He got a lot of pushback from the media and others who claimed that he was motivated by partisanship and not the national interest. And I think we owe him some credit for sticking to his guns, ultimately forcing the government to hold this inquiry, because we've learned a lot, Rudyard. We've learned everything from the flawed process for information and intelligence sharing within the federal government. We've learned when and who within the Liberal Party and the Trudeau government itself received information about foreign interference in our election campaigns. And of course, I think we learn, in my judgment, the extent to which the Prime Minister and people around him preferenced the electoral considerations around Han Dong's candidacy in the 2019 election over the intelligence that was provided to them by CSIS. And I just want to dwell on this point for 1 second, because one thing we learned relative to the Johnston report is that Trudeau is informed about concerns with respect to Han Dong's nomination before the end of the 2019 election. That is to say, he had the opportunity to intervene if he wanted to and remove Han Dong as a Liberal candidate. He chose not to. In effect, him and the Liberal Party's national director substituted their judgment for the national security agencies. And it's not obvious to me that we would have ever known about any of these issues, including the fact that Han Dong subsequently stood for election in 2021, had it not been for the leakers, and then, of course, had it not been for the public inquiry. So that's a very long way to say, someone wrote recently that Pierre Poilievre doesn't care what a lot of people think about him. And, you know, at times that can be a disadvantage. But in this particular case, I think it was an advantage. He didn't care about the noise concerning these issues. And his insistence on a public inquiry, I think, has been ultimately in the best interest of the country.
Yeah, for me, the key takeaway was really the discrepancy that's opened up at the end of the week between Villeneuve's testimony. The director of CSIS urged listeners to check out Steve Chase's tweets in the Globe and Mail today about that testimony, because it really does create a credibility gap between the Prime Minister's contention that before 2023, before reading about it in the Globe and Mail, he was unaware of the extent, the scope, the seriousness of the Chinese threat to our election integrity. And what Villeneuve comes back on the stand, recalled on the stand this Friday,
yes,
and I think sets out in the politest way possible as a public service, but nonetheless emphatically, that he briefed the Prime Minister, cabinet ministers, senior PMO staff repeatedly on the seriousness and severity of this threat from the 2019 election onwards and well before 2023 and the exposés that have begun to appear in the Globe and Mail. And I think what this suggests, Sean, partly is why the leakers leaked. You get a sense of what must have been a perception in CSIS of a complete stonewall by the Prime Minister and the PMO, who I think it's a little too cute by half for the Prime Minister to say, well, I didn't read anything, so therefore all these documented memos are superfluous to my claim that I didn't know anything about 2023. I think he was orally briefed before 2023. Certainly the cabinet ministers, key cabinet ministers were. I think the key thing here, and you nailed it, Sean, in your answer, is that this politics trumped national security. That politically, the liberals, you know, win government with 30% plus of the vote. It's a close run thing for them at the best of times. And if they had come out and either publicly disallowed the Handong nomination or had made noises about the threats that Chinese election interference represented before the and during the 2021 election, if they had informed Mike Chong about the fact that his family in Hong Kong was potentially under surveillance and threat by the PRC, facilitated by a Chinese consular officer in Toronto, this would have alienated the Chinese vote in the six or seven, you know, key ridings here in the GTA, a couple in BC, that they saw as key to their electoral success in 2019, in 2021, and no doubt in the upcoming election. To me, you know, they say follow the money in business. Well, this is follow the politics. I think that's Occam's razor to understand what happened here. These were pretty crass, self-interested political calculations that threw national security and CSIS under the bus.
Yeah, well said. And just to reinforce that point, that Handong remains out of the caucus more than 12 months after he was first ejected, it seems to me, is a sign that the Prime Minister now concedes that he ought not to have been able to run as a Liberal candidate in the first place. But as you say, in the 2019 election, it wasn't self-evident that the Liberals were going to be reelected. And so there was a kind of circle the wagon. And just to reinforce this point again, it's not obvious to me, Roger, in the absence of the leaker and now this public inquiry, we would know any of this stuff. It's clear that it was the intention of the Prime Minister and the government to effectively bury it. And I think you're right that it stands to reason that career public servants raising these issues for, you know, 2-3 years would eventually grow so frustrated that they would resort to leaking this information to the Globe and Mail and Global News.
Sean, you're always really good on these, you know, process of government questions. So let's wrap up this section with the one that I come out of this week, is that you have clearly principled bureaucrats like Vilna, who's heading up CSIS. You have, you know, clearly people in the intelligence services who really had Canada's national security and best interests at heart. But we heard other testimony this week from, you know, Prime Minister's national security advisors, former clerk Charette, who was part of this working group of DMs and others to assess threats. It seems, Sean, like there's just a lot of step and fetch it inside the PMO, and that the bureaucracy there has really lost its ethical center. Like the hewing and the keeling, to use different analogies, to the Prime Minister's whims and preferences and narratives and memories and fine tuning of this phrase and that word is all beautifully echoed and choreographed and dovetailed by this phalanx of PMO officials who owe their appointments to his government. And I walk away with this with a positive sense of the intelligence services, and thankfully, this is still a first world country, some independence between the intelligence services and the PMO. But I leave with a sense of the PMO testimony, especially from the bureaucrats, with real disappointment in the lack of independence and backbone and the ability of these bureaucrats to, you know, call a spade and stand up for institutional and national interests like national security and counsel a prime minister. Isn't that what they're there to do, Sean? Is sometimes not always to be the supplicant, not always to be the facilitator, but to be, in a sense, a kind of check, you know, a genuine interlocutor, not, you know, a servant to whatever the prime minister's desires are.
Yeah, a ton of insight there, Roger, which I couldn't agree more. You mentioned I'm in Ottawa. I was in Toronto early this week for the Public Policy Forum's Grow Summit. And even independent of the question of foreign election interference, I've been hearing more and more, including from former senior public servants, that there's something off in Ottawa, and that Pierre Poilievre, should he ultimately become prime minister, shouldn't underestimate the extent to which he can't merely be thinking about public policy and politics. He needs to be thinking about public administration. Let me just take this up directly, because, you know, I should say, when you're in the foxhole as a political staffer with a public servants, it's natural over time that you're going to build personal relationships and you know, have some investment in one another as people. That's pretty natural. But what we're seeing vis-a-vis the Trudeau government and parts of the public service is something different than that. As you say, whether it's a consequence of a sort of shared worldview or whatever, there are clearly parts of the federal public service that have kind of lost the plot when it comes to the line between the role of the political arm of the government and the public service. It's played out in this particular case. I would argue it played out at times during the SNC-Lavalin case, where we had the clerk of the Privy Council kind of leaning on the Attorney General on behalf of the Prime Minister. And so if you're Pierre Poilievre and you're thinking about organizing a new government, I think you need to be prepared to think seriously about bringing in some outside voices to form part of that deputy minister's community to ensure that you kind of you restore the balance that really is at the heart of Canada's system of public administration.
Great discussion. Let's take a quick break. Back on the other side with managing editor at The Hub, Harrison Lohman, for from the conference floor update on the strong and free networking events going along the last couple of days. What's the big takeaway from this conference? New energy out there. Is the base calling the tune? Is this where the energy is these days in the Conservative Party? We've got that conversation for you right after this short break. Do you have a public policy idea to help solve Canada's shelter and housing affordability crisis? If you do, be sure to check out the Hunter Prize at www.thehub.ca. The Hunter Foundation is offering up to $50,000 in prize money for the best low-cost, high-impact policy idea to make housing and shelter more affordable. Weigh in now with your thoughts, your big thinking on this important public policy challenge, www.thehub.ca. Welcome back to The Hub Roundtable. I'm Rudyard Griffiths, the publisher of The Hub. I'm joined by Sean Speer, our editor-at-large. And for this section, we're going right to the conference floor of the Strong and Free Networking event to hear from Harrison Lohman, managing editor at The Hub, who's been there all week covering the conference. Harrison, first let's talk atmospherics. what's the feel been like there? What are you sensing from this crowd? Give us those atmospherics.
One guy here told me that this is like the Oceaga for conservatives, sort of a concert vibe, right? You guys were just talking about how this government is tired. Well, there's you know, wind in the sails of the people here, right? There's also sort of frustration. I'm just looking at some pins and hats and shirts here on the tables that are surrounding me. This is this should give you a taste of things here. Defund the CRA, socialism kills, I've survived college without being a socialist, scrap the gun buyback. There's some police officers next to me because former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett just gave a speech here and there was a concern about protesters. I think only a few ended up showing up, There was one disturbance when Charlie gave a speech. But I would say that the general vibe here is there's sort of two camps that are being shown, Roger. You've got the old guard, Harperites. Mr. Jason Kenney gave a speech. And then you also have what folks, Sean and I, have come across, we call it sort of the new guard. There's more sort of a populist zeal behind these people. You can imagine the pressure building up for almost a decade. They would like to release that pressure in the next election. Shown during a speech that was given by, of all people, a former British PM, Boris Johnson, who was sort of challenged by the crowd on two fronts. One, they challenged him for how big of a green energy guy he was while he was in power. And he sort of had to talk with jokes. And he also came out of the gate trying to address what is growing sentiment within conservative movements, which is Ukraine skepticism. He's big on Ukraine and supporting Ukraine and supporting that war. And the crowd sort of pushed back there. And he, I think he eventually sort of got them on their side. But that's sort of a taste of what I've seen over the last few days.
Nice, Harrison. Coming from the conference floor of the Strong and Free networking event, Sean, you dipped into the conference last night and today. What was your takeaway?
Yeah, well, Harrison's giving listeners, I think, a sense of the energy reflected in parts of the rank and file. And as he says, there's the usual memes that, you know, one finds in these types of gatherings. But what I've struck by, Rudyard, in a lot of ways is, well, all of that's going on. You're seeing a kind of discipline, professionalism, the return of some old hands who haven't been around for the past few years at these types of conferences. But in a world in which this week Abacus released polling that showed the Conservatives are now up 20 points nationally, 44-24, there is a sense that that people are kind of starting to think about what a Polyev government looks like, who is going to staff key roles. I was struck by the dichotomy between the kind of youthful energy that Harrison's talking about on the floor and the disciplined professional conversations occurring kind of on the margins. People are starting to turn their minds to the next government, everything from the chiefs of staff to cabinet ministers. And as we talked about in the last segment, possible changes within the public service itself.
And Harrison, when you come away from this conference, does the energy meet, do you think, the expectations? Is there a potential gap here, maybe between rhetoric and reality?
Well, this is the thing, right? And I would, just to slightly push back against Sean, they can start by drinking at the same bars. Last night, the two groups I described, it seems they're sort of at different watering holes. But there are moments here where they're sort of coming around at the table, because at the end of the day, they're likely going to form the next government, right? You wonder on the populist side what it looks like in practice when you have your hands in the levers of power, right? Like, how do you turn that anger, that want to tear down systems, into policy and governance? I think that might be a challenge for the next government. There's some tension there, but it's events like these where people can come together and not just see each other from their Twitter profiles, actually sit down at a table, get a sense of where the other person's coming from, and find some sort of common ground.
I would just say, taking off Harrison's point, there is some cool stuff going on policy-wise here, Rudyard, and that might interest listeners. Like, I find myself in the past 24 hours involved in conversations like, how will a Polyev government think about the role of government vis-a-vis the internet? We've had a free internet for, the better part of 25 or 30 years. There's a series of bills passed by the Trudeau government that, represents a kind of philosophical point of view when it comes to the role of government vis-a-vis the internet. How would a Polyev government handle that? There's outstanding questions, of course, about his commitment to defund the CBC. And the list goes on. I guess if I was to convey one takeaway, I don't want to diminish the what Harrison is talking about on the floor of the main conference room, but I'm encountering increasingly sophisticated conversations involving people who were senior officials in the Harper government about the kind of nuts and bolts of governance in the world of a poly of government. And I think it's interesting. That was not last year I attended as well, and it was mostly that energy that Harrison was talking about. But if you were in and around the conference yesterday, there was a lot more gray hair. And I think that is a sense that people are kind of coming out of the woodwork, prepared to, if demanded or if called, join what would be a poly of government.
So Harrison, filing for us Monday on your time at the conference, what should readers expect in the Hub under your byline?
I think some of what I described, right? Like just this, you know, interplay between the, you know, conservatism and populism and which one of those words is capitalized and in which order they are. It's going to be interesting, right? Like, you know, I mentioned there's some people here with some very interesting views, and there's some folks talking about the Great Reset. There's also, to what Sean described, when I was talking to someone this morning, there are people locked away in rooms that are writing out platforms and breaking down policies in terms of how they're going to answer the big questions they have raised over the last few years, and you know, actually creating something.
Well, thanks, Harrison. We look forward to reading your summing up and deep dive on the conference on Monday in the Hub. So readers, listeners, keep an eye out for that. We're going to cram one more topic, as we did last week, three into the show this week. So short break, back to you on the other side. You're one click away from getting access to all the Hub's best analysis and insights. Visit our website, www.thehub.ca now, and sign up for our free weekly email news digest. Every Saturday morning, we'll send to your inbox the cutting-edge thinking and analysis of our smartest contributors on the week that was. Dive in to the big issues and ideas moving the public conversation, courtesy of The Hub. Again, you can grab that exclusive complimentary email newsletter right now at www.thehub.ca. Now back to our program. Welcome back to the Hub Roundtable. Rudyard Griffiths here, the publisher of the Hub, joined by Sean Speer, our editor at large. So, Sean, we've done it. April 12th, the date of the recording of this show, it signifies three continuous years, over 1,000 days of publishing The Hub. We enter year four tomorrow. The marathon continues. Looking back over the last year in particular, what have you seen? What do you think's happening out there in terms of the Hub audience, the platform? It's been quite the year, hasn't it?
Yeah, very exciting year in terms of the growth of our audience, the growth of engagement on the site and across our other channels, and just a general sense, I think, Roger, that the Hub's awareness and influence is growing. I would think, if I had to sum it up in one way, I would say the most gratifying part of the past 12 months, and the reason why I'm as committed to this project today as I was 3 years ago, is I think we can say, honestly and without hyperbole, that we've helped to reshape the conversation in the country when it comes to public policy on issues of economic growth and productivity. You know, 2 years ago, Rudyard, when we started beating the drum on these issues, we were in the wilderness. There wasn't many people talking about them. They were focused on, you know, rebuilding the social contract in the aftermath of the pandemic. And we said, as important as those issues are, if we don't get this economy growing faster, if we don't restore productivity to something resembling the historical norm, not only is there not going to be enough money to pay for all of those ambitious social policies, but something else is going to happen, that we risk sort of devolving into a zero-sum society with all of the conflict and polarization that would follow. And I think we can say this year, productivity was back on the agenda. It was only last month that the deputy bank governor of the Bank of Canada called Canada's poor productivity record a national emergency. And of course, there's been a lot of voices who've been part of that. But I think we can, as I said, I think we can say that that we've played a big role in that. We owe it to our writers and we owe it to our audience who represent a sort of multiplier effect when it comes to these types of issues. But yeah, for me, that's the most exciting part of the past 12 months. How about you?
Yeah, I 100%. I think it's, and I'm really here just to thank the listeners. It's the scale that's starting to get interesting. So in the last 30 days, we had approximately 1 million Canadians on engaged people on one or more parts of our platform. So that whether that's our email newsletter, our podcast channel, the hub.ca, engaging with our content on social. So that to me starts to get interesting. Like we're lapping now in terms of engagement some of the conventional media brands out there, like for instance, McLean's, beating them out in traffic. I will admit at times it's a bit of a race of midgets given the overall state of the the media business right now in Canada. But I think what I see and what's been a lot of fun working with you on is we can be optimistic. There's a lot of really smart, interesting people out there that are meeting through the hub, that we're meeting, that really do care about these types of issues that are tied up in the country's, prosperity, our ability to strive and thrive together. So while at times I know listeners find I can be a bit gloomy on this podcast because a lot of the incoming data of the last while has been kind of stiff medicine, there's something out there that is optimistic to me amongst like the conservative minded members of the Canadian public, which I think, again, partly thanks to Pierre Poilievre, partly thanks, I think, to the after effects of the pandemic. I think that constituency in Canada is growing. I think the reflections on, popularity of the Conservative Party is yes, it's got a big leadership component to it, but I think there's people coming around to remembering that these ideas, these principles work. And we've spent the last decade basically removing them root and branch from our economy, from public administration and the government, from our education systems and our schools. And I think we're all starting to understand the huge opportunity cost that this country has paid for its headlong rush into capital P progressivism, with socialist characteristics, to put it politely. And, I think the hub's the antidote to that. It's a symptom of a growing kind of response by the body politic in Canada that wants to shrug off this this malaise and, rediscover some greatness in the country. So let's do it, man. Year four, it's time to blow off the doors, Sean.
Well, and just in that vein, one thing I want to say is that, we assure listeners and readers that we're not going to spend too much time patting ourselves on the back here. As Rudyard says, tomorrow is the start of year four, and we have big plans. Just to sort of start to give a bit of a sense, on Monday, readers are going to find for the first time a new series that we're launching called Deep Dives, where we're going to kind of put our money where our mouth is. There's been a decline across traditional media when it comes to doing deep dives on economic issues, unpacking, deconstructing those issues for a Canadian audience. And over the next 12 months, every second Monday, beginning this upcoming Monday, our audience will find new deep dives. It seeks to unpack the big economic and social issues facing the country. And we think it's going to be a great product, a huge contribution to public discourse, and something we're excited about. We have a new data journalist starting next week, Rudyard, who's going to be in a position with extraordinary capabilities to take a lot of the great content that we produce, as well as new content that he'll be responsible for, and make it available to our audience in new and creative ways. We have a new seminar series that we'll tell our audience about a bit more later this year. I could go on and on. But at a time when a lot of other players in the industry are stagnant or declining, you're for, as you say, we're putting the pedal to the metal, and our audience can expect a whole host of new and different things, all with the goal of enabling a better public conversation when it comes to issues of public policy and governance, and delivering real value for our just terrific listening and reading audience.
And all, Sean, without accessing government subsidies. So
we're
not going to take this money. We think it's bad for media. It's bad for your trust in the journalism and news and commentary you read. And as we've been talking about the Hub the last couple of weeks, you know, by some point this year, well before potentially the next federal election in 18 months, you know, half of all newsroom costs will be funded by one type of government subsidy or another. So we're going to join a small but mighty band of independent media producers who are going to forego those subsidies to try to remain truly independent, truly able to hold government and the powerful to account by foregoing these, you know, this pernicious and ever expanding subsidy regime for the media. And just, I'll end the show in that spirit, just to thank 8 new Hub fellows who joined in the last 7 days, Sean. $500 lifetime contributions for all the benefits of Hub subscription. So a big thank you to Andrew S., Arvind N., Greg H., James A., Janka V., Laura S., John M., and Zoe C., all coming on board as Hub Fellows. You guys power our independent journalism commentary. You allow us to give a proverbial you-know-what to the subsidy regime that is, I think, really challenging the independence and the veracity of way too much of the media landscape in Canada. So, Sean, that's a wrap for the show. It's been a great year doing this with you. Look forward to soldiering on together in year 4 with our great Hub team.
Hear, hear, and stay tuned. Next week, we have a federal budget on Tuesday, so we'll no doubt have a lot to talk about.
Great. Thanks, everybody, and thank you to Amal Adar-Guzman, the producer of this show. What was it, Sean? Over 340 Hub podcasts in the last 12 months. Some just completely bonkers number that you and Amal produced.
Yeah, I get paid by the word, as far as Amal, as our producer, seems to understand, but she's done a tremendous job. We're so proud of the guests that we're getting. The quality of the guest only keeps going up. And yeah, stay tuned for some exciting stuff in year 4.
Yeah, Tyler Cowan on Hub Dialogues this week with Sean Spear. So check out that interview. Okay, everybody, have a great weekend. We'll see if World War III breaks out in the Middle East over the ensuing 48 to 72 hours. We'll be back to you with updates on that as the week goes on in the Hub, and the roundtable will kick off again next Friday. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Hub Roundtable. If you're looking for great daily analysis and insights on the issues driving the public conversation, check out thehub.ca. Our website gives you access to all the Hub's original news reporting and the thinking of our best writers, including Sean Spear and yours truly, Rudyard Griffiths. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you'll receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was. The Hub Roundtable is produced and edited by Amal Adar-Guzman. Thank you for listening.